Okay, great. Before I launch into the PowerPoint, I just want to open up with a few kind of mega trends that I think are relevant to just the tobacco piece of what we're talking about. First of all, the tobacco industry now is spending just under $40 billion with a B around the world marketing its product. And about $8 billion of that is in the U.S., and amazingly, that's a $4 billion reduction over what they were spending just a decade ago. One mega trend, which I think is probably very similar for big food and for alcohol, is that there's a rapid increase in consumption of tobacco in low middle income countries and now increasingly also in low income countries as they become slightly less low income, such that at the lowest price points, young people can get entry into the tobacco market. And particular products and individual Lucy type products are making that even easier. Another mega trend is that one of the biggest targets globally in terms of tobacco are girls, because they historically smoke at lower levels than boys, as women also smoke at lower levels than men, though they are converging throughout the Western European countries, the US and Canada, and places like Australia. They remain substantially different in low and middle income and low income countries. Recently, I spent time in Ghana, and because I was talking there, I dug into a lot of health statistics, but particularly some of the tobacco trends there. And just to give you one, just to set the stage in a low middle income country, Ghana being a country that just moved from being low income into low middle income, 0.4% of women report that they smoke. And 11% of girls, and that's roughly a 26-fold greater rate between the adult cohort and the cohort that is going to move into with some level of smoking. That particular bit of data for the girls is from the Youth Tobacco Survey, and it only addresses those aged 13 to 15. If it was a cohort that was even 3 years older, those numbers would be higher. And as I think you probably all know, the World Health Organization has suggested that 1 billion people will likely lose their lives this century due to tobacco, the vast majority of those deaths in low, middle income and low income countries. That is in contrast to 100 million people who lost their lives in the first century of the AIDS epidemic. And a statistic I stumbled upon recently and I've been using quite a lot is that we are now very close, I'd say within a year or two, of having the global number of deaths due to lung cancer eclipse the global number of deaths due to AIDS. So that's just a little setting of the stage. And so far, I guess, there we go. Okay. A picture says 1,000 words, and so Joe Camel, as you all know, has been at least semi-retired. His iconic plastic image is still all over the place, but the Master Settlement Agreement banned his image. Is being now replaced by similar types of iconic images, and this particular image is Italy's promotion of Coke Light. And of course, it's a big-eyed skinny girl with the emphasis on zero calories. Alcohol marketing in France, a pink beer that is highly popular. In the U.S., not the newest, but an ill-fated brand, which some of you may have seen on its launch, and one that the Legacy Foundation jumped all over, but we were not alone. We organized an effort of nonprofits around the nation to push back very hard against R.J. Reynolds about this particular campaign, Light and Luscious, Roses and Lace, selling a Camel product, the result of which was a 10% increase among girls aged 11 to 14 in naming Camel as their likely brand if they did smoke or if they were to begin to smoke. That's a cohort study that Jim Pierce has been doing for many years in California, and that was the impact of the introduction of that brand. There had been no movement whatsoever in girls' favorability for the Camel brand until this campaign was launched. They did pull back a lot of elements of the campaign, and a number of women's magazines started to decline their ads as a result of efforts. We not only have ads for, shall we say, not particularly healthy food products that depict the association between their product and weight control, but we also have it for hard liquor in this version of vodka you may have all seen known as Skinny Girl. I'm not going to show you this ad because it would crash my system, but I will tell you about it, and you can go online and see it. It's the Tyson's Chicken Nuggets ad, and it's called, I believe, Yucky. It has now been pulled. I reached out to Tyson's. Many other people, I think, did. I highlighted this ad at a meeting at the IOM. This ad is specifically designed to unsell vegetables and to sell chicken nuggets, and ends with the line showing a multicultural group of young people's hands grabbing chicken nuggets. Give your children what they really want to eat. And this is a photograph from a grocery store in Italy, where at first I just thought it was interesting that everywhere I looked I was seeing cereal products that contained chocolate, until I realized and succeeded in photographing the entire row, which was essentially at least 50 feet long, of all of the cereal products, and they all contained chocolate. So what are some of the tools that are in the toolkit of industries that want to make us consume products that are not really good for us, whether it's food, alcohol in excess, or tobacco products? First of all, they use extensive formative research in order to create public education campaigns that that appeal to their set audience, and frequently, of course, the audience is a youth audience, because many of these behaviors, whether it's addiction to a combination of salt, fat, and sugar, or addiction to nicotine products, or early roots of addiction to alcohol, begin in adolescence. The food industry can do this openly, unlike tobacco and alcohol, which has to be slightly more circumspect in what they do. One of my favorite surveys out there, and with the most ironic acronym around, is Philip Morris's extensive survey about teen attitudes and behavior with regard to smoking, which they nicknamed TABS, of course, keeping tabs on youth. They would do this via phone, and they would call, I think, approximately 15,000 households every year, and they would not disclose to anyone in the household who they were and why they were calling, what company they represented. They later said that to do so would violate the basic tenets of appropriate research and bias the sample. So thousands and thousands of parents every year have their children speaking to people on behalf of Philip Morris, learning many things about their child's behavior, including one of the questions is, how many hours do you spend alone in your room a week? Because they know that the answer to that particular question creates a key vulnerability to some of these types of marketing strategies. Why do brands matter? Well, they matter hugely because for young people, very, very young kids and young teens, they are a means of self-expression. They are one of the principal ways, whether we like it or not, that young people identify themselves and create a combination of identities about themselves. It's for this reason that a now infamous brief article in the New England Journal of Medicine pointed out that among eighth graders, they were 95% recognized Joe Camel, 55% recognized Marlboro Man, and the recognition rates between Mickey Mouse and Joe Camel were roughly equivalent at the height of the marketing campaigns for those brands. The tobacco industry, of course, and you'll hear the same thing when it comes to food and the same thing when it comes to alcohol, frames everything in terms of personal choice and, in fact, takes out full-page ads in newspapers about the importance of the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence, and they do that and have done it in a co-purchase between the alcohol industry and tobacco, which at one point were one and the same when Philip Morris owned both Miller Beer and Kraft Food. Just an aside, in their once secret documents, the reason that they laid out for buying Kraft was, quote unquote, to have a beachhead in every state. They had no interest in being in the food business. They had the interest in being the influence politician's business. Food industry is following its lead, and it's unhampered by such issues as secondhand smoke, because if you're eating your double whopper, the person next to you is not simultaneously becoming overweight, though there is now some new evidence, as we know, from the Framingham study that suggests, in fact, on some level that might be the case. This argument dampens public will to enact policy to reduce marketing and consumption of products that contribute to poor diet, overweight, and obesity. They co-opt influential organizations, and they semi-create influential organizations to do their bidding, such things as the American Dietetic Association, appearing to be the neutral consumer protector, when in fact they are something quite contrary to that. The same with the National Restaurant Association, which has really been the stalking horse for some of the most negative activities that the tobacco industry is up to, particularly with respect to retarding the passage of clean indoor air laws. Studies show that business improves, actually, when restaurants go smoke-free, but the National Restaurant Association does not embrace this research. Shaping policy. As with tobacco, food and alcohol industry executives are involved in shaping relevant policy, and including under certain administrations, and sadly maybe even under the one we currently have way too much input as to the actual language with regard to regulatory processes that under which they fall, which in theory they should be conflicted out of. For a variety of reasons, government officials may value business interests over public health. One of the most common reasons is a dollar sign. Just to give you an example from the tobacco world, and I don't have the analogous figures for alcohol and tobacco, but in state legislatures, on average, 50% of the members accept donations from the tobacco industry. And at the federal level, depending upon whether you're talking about the Senate or the House, anywhere between 50 and 75% accept money from the tobacco industry. And in fact, the tobacco industry has been known to auto-generate checks so that you then have to proactively reject the check in order to be, you know, not be a recipient of it if it comes directly into your fundraising operation. Sadly, and I think terribly, and I think probably highly similar to what is going on in alcohol and food, the tobacco industry notoriously created a great deal of new science in order to drown out real science, and then at the same time called the real science junk. Two tobacco companies disseminated national mass media campaigns ostensibly to prevent smoking. Both of those campaigns were found to actually be associated with increased intentions to smoke and literally, in one case, increased smoking. So I'm running very much out of time, so I'm just going to mention one campaign that I think you're probably all familiar with. That's the Truth Campaign, which succeeded in basically pushing back against a major industry so successfully that it was responsible for 22% of the overall decline in youth smoking for a substantial number of years. The result being that about 450,000 fewer youth began smoking. A similar type of campaign could certainly be launched with respect to both alcohol and food. And I think that is something that the tobacco industry, the tobacco wars have taught us, and something that we should try to find a way to fund in the world of alcohol and of food. So if we could do that, I think we'd be taking a great step forward with something like Food Truth and Alcohol Truth. Thank you.